Hello, I'm Roger Duan, Vice President at IHS Market, and I would like to welcome you to a CRW conversation presented by IHS Market with Mark Viviano today, Head of Public Equity with Kimmeridge Energy Capital Management, a private equity firm focused purely on the development of commercial assets in US E&P. Mark, this week we saw quite dramatic development with negative prices in the US, illustrating in a way the very difficult situation the US E&P sees itself right now. But even before the crisis, the E&P sector was the worst performing sector in the market for the last decade, with low return, capital fleeing the space, and what many believe to be a broken business model, a model that managed to grow volumes, but with very little profits. You and I have been discussing this business model for some time, and what public investors would want it to look like in the next cycle. Until recently, you were managing director and portfolio manager at Wellington Management, and now with Kimmeridge Capital, where you're launching a fund to invest in public markets. So Mark, first, let me welcome you to CRW Conversations.
Thanks, Roger. Thanks to IHS, and it's a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thank you for being here. Mark, you've been investing in oil and gas for a long time now, and you have been consistent in saying that the shale producer have to change their mindset and their business model to attract back equity investor. What was your real criticism of the shale model 2.0, if I can call it, so the way it was until a few months ago?
Sure. As you know, I, along with several other investors in the sector, recognized starting back in 2017 that the E&P business model needed to evolve. And that was a direct result of witnessing how the recovery in oil prices off the bottom in 2016 led to the green lighting of materially higher activity levels rather than a reduction in absolute debt or any return of capital to shareholders, who essentially provided a lifeline to the industry with the wave of equity raises back in 2015 and 2016. And then over the past few years at Wellington, I had witnessed firsthand how the E&P sector had become uninvestable to the majority of generalist investors. And it was uninvestable for two reasons. First, with the legacy issues around poor capital allocation and misaligned incentives. Well, more recently, it was the structural headwinds associated with the energy transition.
Yeah.
So we saw the urgency to reform the E&P business model and devoted a lot of our resources to engaging with the management teams as well as the boards of directors on these issues. And what you saw materialize from those discussions is what you're referring to as shale 2.0. And what that really entailed was lowering the reinvestment rate for the industry from 130% of cash flow down to 95 to 100%, growth rates of 5 to 10, 15% versus 20 to 40, and some token dividend announcements. But in my view, that was just a watered down version of the old business model. Nothing fundamentally changed because the industry was still attempting to solve for a growth rate while the free cash flow generation was still a residual of the model and fully dependent on higher oil prices. And the concept of spending within cash flow as a measure of capital discipline or a strategic objective is absurd to most non-energy investors.
So actually, you've been talking about that for some time, and you've been trying to think about what 3.0 shale would look like, correct?
Yep.
And you wrote actually with Kimmeridge a white paper where you can outline what shale 3.0 would look like for a public investor like you who would want to invest in the sector. Can you tell us a little bit how you saw that and what are the key metrics you're looking for?
Sure. The white paper we published back in March outlined our vision for successfully evolving the E&P business model. For these companies to become investable again and to align their model with the energy transition, they need to materially reduce reinvestment rates to a maximum of 70% while providing visibility into returning 100% of the enterprise value in cash over the next 10 years while resetting the cost base, improving the environmental footprint, and better aligning management incentives with shareholder interests.
That's a very different sector you're describing here than what we have. So the question is, first, do you think that the resource base, the capital available, and the economics really of shale can accommodate that? And I have a second question is, are there segments of the oil industry who manage to do something like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, in the model we're talking about, where you're starting with the assumption of 30% of your cash flows going to either the balance sheet or to shareholders before anything's reinvested in the business, means that depending on the quality of the company's asset base and the oil price, production may rise or fall. It's not a business model that every company is going to be successfully implementing. But the production volume should be the output of the model, not the input. And to your question about where have we seen this be successful, I think refining is a great example of this. That is an industry where there are terminal value concerns. When you think about gasoline demand growth in the U.S. is likely to peak before global oil demand. And it has a inferior ESG footprint to the upstream industry because, as you know, 70 to 80% of the greenhouse gas emissions from the petroleum industry come from the downstream and from the fuels that are combusted at the consumer level. But yet very few people push back on investing in the refining sector based on the ESG profile. And it was the most successful from a shareholder experience over the last decade in the energy sector.
So how do you realign, if you want, that interest between the shareholders, the companies, the management, the boards, to get to a situation like that where growth at all costs is not the goal, but really to have a profitable industry?
Well, I mean, ultimately, we believe the root cause of the industry's problematic behavior and why activism is likely required to reform it is the misalignment of interest between management teams and investors. I mean, if you just look at the short-term CEO incentive compensation relative to company share price performance, these management teams continue to get paid well above 100% of their target bonuses while destroying value on a historic scale because the compensation is tied to either operational targets or relative rather than absolute shareholder returns.
So how those conversations are going right now? I mean, you had a lot of contact with a lot of these companies when you were at Wellington, and I'm sure you restarted that conversation. How do you realign that to make the sector investable?
Well, I mean, I think that's where the role of activism is going to come into play. Because when I was at Wellington, we went down the traditional engagement path that other large institutional investors attempt, which is really to have a discussion with both the CEOs and the boards of directors on what needs to change. But what I can tell you is that a lot of that change was very incremental. And it wasn't aligned with the urgency we saw in evolving the model. So ultimately, to get results, we think activism is going to play an important role.
Okay, so that was the discussion we were having the last few months. And obviously, since then, we had this dramatic crisis, correct? So we have a big decline in prices and probably also a big decline in production in the United States. So how do you see actually the sector emerging from that? And then we'll talk about how you're thinking implementing a Shale 3.0 into that sector after the crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I thought ISI had a good title for a research report the other day that said, you put out the fire before redesigning the house. And obviously, reforming the business model or redesigning the house is nearly impossible when it's on fire, which it clearly is at $10 or $20 oil. The need for activism today is minimal because these companies all know what to do. Lay down rigs, suspend completions, shut in production, cut costs, and preserve liquidity. Clearly, what we're talking about here is redesigning the house, so we'll have to wait until the fire is fully extinguished. But evolving the business model does become easier coming out of the crisis, and that's because these companies have been given the opportunity to finally jump off the treadmill. Transitioning the model to what we're talking about when a company has a 40% decline rate and a high valuation multiple tied to growth expectations would be admittedly difficult. But after the dramatic CapEx reductions this year and what will be a year or two of falling production, decline rates will moderate and the maintenance CapEx to sustain the business will reset to materially lower levels, especially with further service cost deflation. And then these management teams and boards have a critical decision to make. Do they use those moderated decline rates as a platform for reattempting to recover the productive capacity lost during the downturn? Or do they structurally transform the business model? And I think that's ultimately going to determine the winners and losers coming out of this crisis.
Well, it's also, I imagine, determined by the global context and how shale fit into that global context. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think in your thesis, too, that was very important, is how to think shale globally and how does it fit the global supply picture?
Yeah, I think it's become very clear that shales should be the swing producer as the short cycle barrel. But that hasn't necessarily been the case over the last 5 years, because we've seen years of consistent 1 million barrels a day growth, regardless of what the balances implied the market needed from a supply perspective. And so if you go to the back to the model that we were discussing, there should only be a capital available to grow production when there's an appropriate price signal. The production base of all these shale companies needs to be much more variable and responsive to the commodity, while the free cash flow is what needs to be more durable through the cycle.
Well, obviously here we're going to go through a big decline in demand, and all production globally is going to come down, and I think shale will take a fair share of that. So in many ways, that reform you're asking for, the market is enforcing it in dramatic consequences, and we will have a much smaller sector probably to rebuild from 2 years from now, correct? So how do you see all these bankruptcies and potential bankruptcies happening, and how does it reform the sector in the next 2 years?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, clearly the ability to survive this crisis is largely going to be a function of financial liquidity. And there is a meaningful bifurcation in the liquidity profiles of these shale companies, depending on legacy investment grade versus high yield status, due to the vast differences in financial covenants. What you typically see in a high yield E&P company is reserve-based facilities that carry quarterly redeterminations based on revised commodity price decks, along with debt to EBITDA covenants, which are all likely to get triggered in an extended $20 to $30 oil price environment. Conversely, most investment grade rated companies have unsecured credit facilities without periodic redeterminations, and the only financial covenant is something like a debt to capital ratio. So the larger companies with scale are going to come out of this even better positioned on a relative basis.
So you'll have a consolidation around bigger companies, or just bankruptcies of a lot of companies in the tail end of the production curve?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're going to see a significant amount of bankruptcies. The question is, how are those companies restructured? What does the ownership profile look like? And what is the business strategy coming out of bankruptcy? Unfortunately, for a lot of the companies that went bankrupt during the 2015 to 2016 period, a lot of them got recapitalized and resorted to a growth mentality coming out of that. I think we need to ensure that doesn't happen again. And you asked about consolidation. I mean, typically you see very little M&A activity at the depths of a downturn because everybody's busy putting out their own fires, and then it tends to accelerate in the recovery phase. But the issue we have, and why I think the reaction to consolidation in the shale era has been so poor, is that there are so few management teams that investors trust with their existing asset base, let alone on taking on someone else's. So for consolidation to really be successful, somebody needs to prove they can execute a superior business model that is better aligned with shareholder interests, which can garner a premium valuation. That premium currency would allow for accretive acquisitions, but it can't happen until there's a wider spread in relative multiples. I mean, just mashing together two bad business models doesn't make it more attractive to investors.
Yeah. Part of the sector is really based on private equity money and private equity companies. And Kimmeridge Capital is a private equity company, but you're running a public fund. So I want to talk a little bit about the private side, because it's a big part of the industry, and there is a lot of capital still available to come into the sector. So how that is being impacted by the crisis now, and how do you think it's evolving over the next 2 years?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think the PE model for shale has fundamentally changed. As you know, for the initial phases of the shale revolution, it largely resembled a venture capital model of backing a management team, identifying a unique geological trend, acquiring acreage, drilling appraisal wells, and selling it to a public operator. That model of resource capture is largely over, but private equity is going to need to play a significant role in the upstream industry because it is some of the only long-term durable capital remaining in the sector. But I suspect it looks a lot more like a typical PE model in other sectors, where you acquire a non-core underperforming asset and you turn it around with operational expertise and a capital injection. We've started to see that in places like the North Sea or other international basins with some success. But the financial model is going to be more about extracting cash flows out of a mature asset rather than flipping undeveloped acreage to another operator for multiples of your entry price.
Well, but that changes really the private equity model in bringing return rather than being able to exit the business 3 to 5 years later. How do you see that possible? So, I mean, these are more yield companies?
Yeah, I think it's going to be about what type of income you can receive from the asset base rather than the multiples of reinvestment from an undeveloped asset. I think return expectations will have to change. Now, there's a different risk profile as well. So as you know, what matters is the risk-adjusted returns. And when you're talking about producing assets, you're talking about a much different risk profile than undeveloped acreage.
But is the capital behind the private equity looking for a model like that, or there is a mismatch there?
No, I think you're starting to see a shift in the behavior of the private equity sponsors and the fact that they recognize there's very little opportunity to flip assets to public operators anymore.
Yeah, and we're seeing that right now. We're seeing a lot of private company kind of collapsing a number of companies in a smaller number to consolidate, have less management team, less G&A, and be able to become more a yielding vehicle rather than a full growth vehicle. I want to come back to this notion of activism, because I think it's very important the way we think about it here. How do you think, or how do you intend to use that model going forward?
Well, like I alluded to earlier, I think the first step in successful activism is changing the management incentives within these companies. The fundamental problem with using relative TSR as the primary benchmark is that it promotes pro-cyclical behavior. Because if you attempt to grow the company and you get a tailwind from the commodity, you look like a hero. And if oil prices fall and the model's impaired, you just blame your fate on the unpredictable nature of the commodity. I think the highly publicized payout to the senior management team at Whiting into their restructuring is just the most recent example of the asymmetry of management incentives in the sector. And that's putting it politely. I'm just not sure how that changes without activism.
So once you do that, I think you put the set of metrics that you would be really looking for going forward into that public fund versus the private equity side of the business, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, if you change the management incentives, and it's not necessarily about making sure CEOs are paid less, it's making sure that their pay is aligned with the outcome for shareholders, I think you give the opportunity to a larger investor base to come back to the sector.
Yeah. So how optimistic you are for investors in this next cycle in shale? I mean, is this a place where capital will come back, you think?
I think it's going to take time. I think we have to be realistic about how much value destruction there was over the past decade, that investors are still licking their wounds from how much money was lost in the shale era. I don't think these companies are going to get paid for the messaging. And that's something I've told them all along, that it's not about saying the right things and expecting investors to embrace the model. It's going to have to take several years of seeing reported financial results from a differentiated model. But I think given the starting valuations for these companies and where we are in the oil cycle, there's a generational opportunity within the sector if these companies behave properly.
Well, we might have an example coming in front of us here on the gas side of the shale business. There's a perception that the decline in oil production will force a bigger decline in gas production and that prices will recover. And actually, we believe that these shale gas companies are going to need to attract capital to be able to drill and provide the amount of gas necessary in the next 2 years. Do you think their capital will be available, and are we seeing some discipline in the way that capital will be allocated and spent?
Yeah, I think the willingness for investors to put equity capital into any of these companies is limited today. I think when you talk specifically about the gas market, many are in a wait and see mode, which is we all know that if oil production declines over the next 2 years, you're going to see associated gas decline with it. The question then becomes, at what gas price does dry gas drilling get reactivated, particularly when a significant portion of that is currently owned by private equity companies in places like the Haynesville? I think there's just a lot of uncertainty. I think you can paint a wide range of outcomes depending on how the industry behaves. But again, it all comes back to what is the level of discipline rather than the expectation that a higher commodity price should necessarily be associated with higher production growth.
Yeah, I mean, with investors looking for a company which are willing to hedge up front to guarantee a return or something like that, or will wait to see the prices really rise before the capital becomes available?
Yeah, I think the investor base largely wants to see a sustainable business model. So short-term spike in commodity prices, whether it's hedged or not, is really not what's going to attract capital back into the sector. Going back to the refining analog, you go back to 2010, 2011, refining was the most hated sector within energy. And I remember it well because I covered the sector back then, and nobody wanted to own any of these companies. But it really took 3 years of improving returns on capital, higher distribution to shareholders, and better consistency of reported earnings. But 3 years on, it was the most loved sector within energy. And there are a lot of generalist portfolio managers that wouldn't own E&P companies, but would own refining. And because you were starting at such a low valuation level, there were very attractive returns. I think there could be similarities and parallels between those subsectors, but it only happened with a fundamental change in the way capital was allocated and the way CEOs ran those companies.
And we're entering an era with probably less capital available to the sector and probably more difficult conditions. So, however, I like your message of hope here that there is a new model that would work. The metrics have to change. The management incentive had to change, but the crisis is largely doing that. So I think that's a little bit the message of hope we have here, and at the same time to watch carefully to the gas market, which could be ahead by a year or two because the demand profile looks a lot better. Thank you, Mark, for joining us this afternoon for a CERAWeek conversation presented by IHS Market. Hopefully, we'll see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.